Does the U.S. government know more than it's saying about UFOs? Does the deep state exist? And what is the deep state? Today we talk with author and ufologist Kevin D. Randall about his latest book, UFOs and the Deep State, War Against the Truth. We're here to find that truth. So get your questions ready. Hopefully, retired Lieutenant Colonel of the United States Air Force, Kevin Randall, can catch us up to speed and give us that wake-up call to what has and is being hidden. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to Truth Be Told Studios, the one and only Kevin D. Randall. There he is. How you doing?
I hate to correct you so first, but I retired from the Army as a Lieutenant Colonel.
Well, I got it's a military, so we're a quarter of the way there. So
there we go.
Well, I appreciate the correction because we don't want to take away from the Army because both my parents were Army also. So
there you go.
Well, I'm excited to have you here because we have a lot to talk about. Your brand spanking new book is released tomorrow, and UFOs and the Deep State. This is something that, truth be told, we love, and because we are starting today the Contact in the Desert series, and right after this, we have another ufologist that we're going to be talking to. But we appreciate you being on the show with us. So, first of all, we were talking before, you have had so many books that you've have written, but what's so relevant and what's so special about this specific book? Because, you know, when we talk about UFOs and deep state, there's that it opens a lot of questions. So could you tell us about your book and what's it about?
It kind of says it all in the title.
Right.
But it's looking at the UFO phenomenon from a different point of view, a different way of examining it, and it's seeing how the deep state affected the UFO research over the years.
Right.
And the deep state is sort of a shadow government, I think, is another term for it. It's a term that refers to the bureaucracy. Now, we elect our officials every 4 years or every 2 years or every 6 years, depending mm-hmm. on the points in Congress they're going to, or the presidency. But the bureaucrats stay on forever. They're appointed in one administration and they go on literally forever, and they right. amass a great deal of power by doing that. If we look at President Biden's cabinet and appointees now, there are an awful lot of the people who were appointed during the Obama administration, and some mm-hmm. of them from the Clinton administration, some of them from the Bush administration. So it shows that these people just kind of live in that bureaucracy forever, and by amassing the power, they can direct an awful lot of the way things go, and direct the way things go to a great extent by providing the expertise to the elected officials, and they have to live or die by that information.
Well, let me ask you this: when you say a lot of the deep state, or mostly these people that have been around for decades, and they seem to be intertwining in a lot of the presidential team. What about the presidents themselves? Because you see, you know, they get in there. A lot of them, like, oh, if I get in there, I'm gonna disclose the UFO phenomenon. Then you get in there and you hear nothing, and then they get out of the office and they go on these talk shows and they go, Well, what's going on? Did you have access? And never saw anything that was worth talking about. So why are sometimes they're so gung-ho before they get into the presidency, and then when they get out, they're just silent?
I have said for a long time, if I'm the president, I can get any information I want.
Right.
I say to the Director of Central Intelligence, what's going on in UFOs? And he says, well, sorry, sir, I can't tell you, you're not clear to know. And I say, you're fired, bring in your deputy. And go down the line until I get somebody who'll tell me what I want to know. But in the book, I actually explore that a little bit. There's a fellow named Dan Sheehan, and I talked to him about this. He entered the picture, if you will, during prior to the Carter administration. Carter had been elected president, but he had not been inaugurated yet. And Sheehan was brought in to kind of research some of this sort of thing. And what Dan Sheehan told me was that Carter had a meeting with the director of Central Intelligence, who happened to be George H.W. Bush.
Right.
And talking to him, he said, well, Mr. Bush, I'd like to know what you can tell me about UFOs. And Bush said, well, Mr. President-elect, or Mr. Carter, I would like to stay on as director of Central Intelligence after you're inaugurated. And Carter said, well, I'm sorry, I've got a guy picked out for that, and he'll be coming in. And Bush's response is, well, you know, you don't really have a need to know this stuff. You're not president yet. I suggest you follow a different avenue. And he shut the door on him. What's Carter going to do? Fire him? Well, he's already told him he's fired.
Right.
After the inauguration takes place, he's out of a job. There's a transitional period. And so I think that kind of explains part of it. The other thing you have to understand is that if I'm the president and I ask the DCI or whomever about UFOs, and there's things that I don't want to tell that president, knowing that he's going to be gone in 4 years or he's going to be gone in 8 years, whatever the case may be, I can stonewall him. I say, well, you know, Mr. President, there's an awful lot of this material out there, and it's spread over a number of different agencies, and I would sure like to help you out here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up a panel, or I'm going to set up an investigation. We're going to pull all that information together, and we'll brief you on it when we get it all together and give you a clear picture of what's going on, hoping that, A, the president will forget about it,
right,
or, B, other crises will raise their ugly heads and attention will divert it. And by the time they eventually get back around to it, well, there's a new guy coming in and he's got the same questions and we pull the same stunt again.
Yeah.
So there are ways of dodging the question so that the man in charge never really gets the information he wants. I think in some cases, it's a kind of a personal thing they want to know. I want to know it personally, but it's not a driving force that from the government for them to take a look at. And I think that kind of feeds into it as well. But I've explored a couple of ways in the book in which the president can be diverted. He's not necessarily refused the information. His attention is diverted for a period of time. And there's always the possibility they give him an incomplete picture. Well, there's really nothing to it. And here's what we have. And you can call these various other officials and they'll tell you basically the same thing. You know, here are the list of the sources we use and what they know.
And I think that's true because, you know, like we know, most presidents, you know, are no more than 8 years. And do you believe that the president, you know, not getting into the biggest, you know, two big conspiracy things, but actually have the power? I mean, to get the information, because military generals and a lot of these ranking officers, again, they're lifetime career people, and they know that they're going to see 3, 4, maybe 5 presidents in their lifetime as a military officer. Do you feel the deep state also pours over into the military?
Yeah, I do. You look at the men and women who raise to the top ranks, the 4-star ranks, the 3-star ranks in the military. They're usually pretty much political animals. I mean, a good exception would be George Patton, who wasn't much of a political animal, but
right.
He was a good general.
Right.
Or look at Douglas MacArthur, who rose to top levels, but he was fired by Truman. And I'm not sure I understood exactly why Truman fired him, other than he felt that Douglas MacArthur had too much power outside his military organizations. But it's all about politics and it's all about power. That's where the important thing lies. And it's about retaining that power. And I think, and it's one of the questions I look at in the book, or I try to answer in the book, is why does the secrecy persist today? Because we accept Roswell as being alien. If we accept Roswell as being alien, then we've known about this for nearly 75 years.
Right.
And there is nothing going on there that would impact our lives today. If the president said tomorrow, you know, aliens have visited, and you look back and say, well, you know, I've been around for 40, 50 years and nothing's happened to me, so why do I care? I think it's about retaining power. And the problem is, when a technologically superior civilization comes in contact with a technologically inferior civilization, that technologically inferior civilization ceases to exist, not necessarily through conquest or invasion. The mere introduction of the technology alters that civilization. And we've seen all kinds of examples of that throughout our history in the anthropological world,
right?
Where the introduction of the horse by the Spanish radically altered the life of the tribal, the tribes in the Central Plains, for example, mm-hmm. turning them into much more nomadic organizations than they were and creating a different way for them to live. The introduction of the horse. A steel pot or an iron pot is a much better cooking utensil than a clay pot. And those civilizations, the Indian civilizations, didn't have the technology to create the iron pots. Some of them did, but the Plains Indians, for example, did not. And they become reliant on those things. And the only place to get those is to go to the people who can manufacture them. There was an anthropologist who wanted to study a primitive tribe. The primitive tribe had a very ritualized system for borrowing a stone axe. Hmm. They had to go through the chain of command. They had to go up to their leaders to borrow these stone axes. The anthropologist showed up with a supply of steel axes, much better than a stone axe. And to induce the people to talk to him, he would give them stone axes and thereby undercut part of the social pinnings of that civilization, not meaning to do it. The mere introduction of that technology altered that civilization. And I think they understand that at the highest levels here, that an admission that there is alien visitation, which certainly suggests a technologically superior civilization, will radically alter life on Earth. And even if they haven't introduced themselves to us yet, there's that possibility they're going to do it tomorrow. And how will that technology affect our civilization, our economies, and everything else?
Mm. And one thing that I've noticed, it was actually Roswell, maybe even a little bit, some incidents before that where actual UFO encounters or crashes or something that really made headlines to where it really perked the interest of the people of America. But so the deep state have been part of this cover up for a while. But going back, how far can you take the deep state back when it comes to the UFO cover up? Even before Roswell, how far back have you done research to, is it 1800s? I mean, the beginning of this country? I mean, how far back can you?
When you talk about UFOs,
right?
I think I can take their influence back to World War II and the Foo Fighters.
Okay.
And we can see there was a fellow named Howard McCoy who was tasked by the U.S. government during the Second World War as part of an investigation into the Foo Fighters. It was a multinational investigation. It had the British and the French and everybody else involved on our side involved in trying to discover what this was. When the war ended, of course, the emphasis on this disappeared. Nobody cared anymore. But then the ghost rocket started in Sweden, and it was the same thing. And Howard McCoy was involved in the investigation of ghost rockets. And when we get into the late 1946, Howard McCoy is tasked by the U.S. government, or more importantly, the Air Materiel Command, to set up an unofficial investigation of UFOs. I think it was like in one office with a locked door until Kenneth Arnold's sighting, and suddenly it became official and everything changed there. So I can take the deep state interest in UFOs back to the Second World War. If you're looking about the deep state influence prior to that, in the book I talk about when Franklin Roosevelt was elected, there was an awful lot of people who did not like his politics.
Right.
Isn't that a stunning surprise?
Right.
And there's a Marine general named Smedley Butler, who actually had two medals of honor. Would have had three, but the Marines didn't give the Medal of Honor to officers during the first activity. It would have earned him the Medal of Honor. He would be the only person to ever have received three. A group of businessmen and others, outsiders from the Democratic Party, approached him, and what they wanted to do was set him up as the chief of staff or an important role in the White House, and he would be running things, and Roosevelt would be more or less a figurehead. To Butler's credit, he said no. turned the information over to the news media and went before Congress. There was a big investigation about it in the 1930s. The information is in the book, and the links to the various or the websites that can provide more information about that is there as well. So you can read the whole story. The point simply is that was an example of the deep state attempting to take over the presidency. And because of the Marine general, they were unable to do so. I don't think Roosevelt would have been the kind of man that would have allowed that to happen, even if they'd tried it. I don't think they would have been able to wrestle the power away from him, no matter how important General Butler had become in the White House. But he refused to do it, to his great credit. And I think that shows the deep state operating there. And we can look at the influences of industry. We can look at the influence of outsiders pressuring the government to do things that they want done, and they have the power to do it because they have the money or they have the technology or they have the wherewithal to kind of force the government into those things. And we can see it throughout history. We just have to look a little bit below the surface to get a good picture of that.
So what was so significant about World War II? Was it the Germans' discovery, and I know working on anti-gravity and looking for other UFO technology, and we just found out that they were looking for it. Why not World War One? Why not before that? Around World War Two, we did see a huge speed up of technology and getting into space and just computers and pretty much everything very shortly after that. But why not World War One? What was the significant, and what was that change that made us getting interested in UFO technology?
Well, it was the Foo Fighters.
That just
they didn't know what they were. And they exhibited technology that was superior to anything we had.
Right.
We understood, as the Germans understood and the Japanese understood, that air superiority was the key to victory.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't the only key to victory, but it was a very important part of it. And if the Foo Fighters were a technology developed by the Germans or developed by the Japanese, I leave the Italians out of it. but if they could deploy that technology, then they could sweep our air forces from the skies. The Germans misapplied the Me-262, the jet fighter. They didn't deploy it properly, because had they used it as a fighter plane as opposed to the way they did, that technology would have been very, very dangerous. Actually, I think that picture is of a David Vincent UFO painted up to look like.
Right. Yeah. I'm just trying to find some stuff to visually show people.
Yes, but I think it was the Foo Fighters that did it, and they were trying to figure out, is this a technology the Germans and the Japanese have developed, and how can we counter it? Is it going to affect the war in the air? And when the war ended, that priority disappeared. They were no longer interested in it because there was no longer a threat. And it slowly developed over the next few years. As I said, the ghost rockets from 1946 in Sweden. I think Finland first, Sweden, and then the Scandinavian, then Northern Europe. And then there was stuff going on that was of interest to our government in late 1946 into 1947 until the Kenneth Arnold sighting. So they were kind of looking at these sorts of things, but it was the appearance of the UFOs in greater numbers. We can look back to other instances of UFO sightings. I think the Great Airship of 1897. I think the majority,
Texas.
I think most of those were hoaxes. I think most of those were people making stuff up. And you read the accounts, and you can see that it's stuff being made up. There's very little meat there. Jerry Clark and I disagree on that all the time. He thinks there's a core of solid sightings, and I'm not sure there is. But the point simply is that kind of stuff went away. So when you look at World War One, we didn't have that kind of sudden advancement or seeming advancement by our competitors in the war. When we get to World War II, we do see that sort of thing, and that kind of sparked the interest, and that's what carried on through until basically today.
Why do you think there was kind of a, if that's true, there wasn't as many sightings or anything like that before that? Why do you think so much more was it just more knowledge or more interest during World War II? And I know the Foo Fighters and Japan and all that, but before that, I mean, we've heard you know, people seeing UFOs. We've seen interest in UFOs. We called them, you know, flying saucers, but they called them saucers. What was there like a dry period where they just weren't here as much as during the mid 1900s?
We can look at the history of UFO waves. Gary Clark in his UFO encyclopedia, I should say Jerome Clark,
right?
That's the name on the encyclopedia, looks at the waves and points out that there were waves of sightings. But I think the problem is when you look at, say, again, the airship of 1897, if you read the stories all the way through, follow the trail all the way through,
right,
they usually disappear. There was, and the best example I can think of is my own research. I was usually go to when I was in a place, I would go to the newspaper morgues and I would look up the UFO stories and I would come across the sightings of the airship. And I found some in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and it talked about the guys taking a trip to around in one of the airships. And I thought, this is great. And I copied the article and I left. And I came back the next day and I said, let's see what's going on the next day. And the next day, it turns out the ship landed, crashed in Waterloo, Iowa. And there's actually a photograph of it. This airship from 1897 in the Waterloo, Iowa fairgrounds. And so the story from Cedar Rapids kind of ended because they recognized who the people were and what they were talking about. And now we have the airship in Waterloo, Iowa, an actual airship.
Mm-hmm.
But that turned out to be a hoax as well.
Oh, okay.
And I think when you follow all these stories along as much as you can, they all dwindle away. The Aurora, Texas one is very problematic because Aurora, Texas, of course, is in Wise County. And I was there in 1972 looking into this stuff. And I talked to the people at the Wise County Historical Society about this story. And they said they didn't believe it. I said, why not? And they said, well, and I think it was, there were two books about the history of Wise County that were printed in the decade after the crash, in the 10 years following the crash. Neither of them mentioned the story.
Hmm.
Now, here's something that would have been known to everybody in town had it happened. It would have been a big deal to everybody in town had it happened. But the histories of Wise County don't mention it in any way, shape, or form. And to me, that's very problematic, suggesting that that too was a hoax. And I think that, you know, you look at it, well, maybe they suppress the information, but who and why? In today's world, we could point fingers at organizations from the CIA to the Air Force to all kinds
right.
of organizations who work very hard to derail investigations and to misdirect the investigations and deny things that are going on. We have that, and we know that, and we can prove that. But in 1897, there was no such organization. CIA didn't exist. The Air Force
right.
didn't exist. Nobody cared. The people who are mentioned in the newspaper articles were all local people. I think the T.J. Weems, who was supposedly a Signal Corps officer, you know, think intelligence, a Signal Corps officer, turned out to be the local blacksmith and things like that. So you look at that. But when we get to the 1940s into the Foo Fighters, there we have no explanation. This is something that we thought the Germans and the Japanese were developing. When the war was over, we questioned the Germans and the Japanese, and they said, no, we thought they were yours. So clearly there was something else going on, and that kind of sparked the interest. Then you have the ghost rockets, and nobody's really offered a satisfactory explanation for that. I know at one time the explanation was it was the Soviets trying to intimidate the Scandinavians, especially in Sweden. But now that the Soviet Union has collapsed and we've had all kinds of researchers going into the archives of the former Soviet Union, the Soviet Union wasn't responsible for it either. So we've got That's those right. sorts of things going on. But I think it's the point is there was a mystery that developed during the early 1940s, during the Foo Fighters, during the ghost rockets, that evolved into something going on in the United States that caused an investigation. There was a sighting from Virginia, weather station in Virginia in March or April of it, in 1947, that really got no play in the press. It came up, we learned about it after, of course, Kenneth Arnold's sighting. But it shows that the information was being gathered by the military at the time, that they were doing it quietly, and they could do it quietly because nobody's interested until the thing blew up in the newspapers in June of 1947. And then
right.
then we all get involved in it.
Is there one branch of the military that's, because it seems to be a lot of Air Force. Maybe that's why I said Air Force earlier. But there seems to be a lot of the Air Force, excuse me, releasing, you know, footage and being on site and all kind. Is there one branch of the government that seems to have more knowledge of the UFO phenomenon?
The Army had it first.
Yeah,
because it was the Army
47, right?
And the Army, of course, split, the Air Force split off from the Army in 1947, and they inherited the UFO investigation.
That's fascinating.
That was the public face of it. We now see the Navy deeply involved in UFO investigation. There was a document that came out, I think, in 1949, where two naval officers with top secret clearances were tasked with finding out what was going on. And they spent a great deal of time of looking into it, and they found nothing about Roswell, for example, but they also pointed out that they didn't get into everything. Their clearances didn't take them everywhere, but it was something that the Navy had done. When the Navy warrant officer, Delbert Newhouse, filmed the objects near Tremonton, Utah in July of 1952, the Navy got deeply involved because here was a naval officer who had filmed objects in the sky that were unidentified. The Navy said, well, we don't know what they are. We think they're unidentified. The Air Force finally said, well, they were seagulls, and it kind of fooled the guy. Didn't bother with the description that Newhouse and his family had made of what the objects were prior to that conclusion. They'd seen the object close up, and they looked like saucers. When he finally got his camera out, his movie camera out, and was able to film the things, they moved off in the distance and weren't quite as distinct as they had been when they flew over his car, which caused him to stop and
right.
get out his movie camera. So we can look at the Navy being deeply involved. The Air Force claimed that they stopped their investigation in 1969 with the end of Project Blue Book. 1947 stuck in my brain for some reason. but when they concluded that investigation in 1969, but we have evidence that continued to investigate some of these things. It depended on the sighting and it depended on what was going on. They actually investigated the Roswell case in the mid-1990s. They didn't really investigate the case. What they did was go to various organizations and task them with looking for documentation. And if you do that, you're not going to find what you're looking for, because the organizations, if it is highly classified, aren't going to come out and say, yeah, we got this stuff. They're going to say, no, we have no documents that are responsive to your request. So
right.
That's the end of that. But we look at the Air Force, but we can look at the Department of Defense being involved in it. And then we can take a look at the CIA, which is involved in it, and other organizations like that. And that's when I say, you know, the deep state is involved, because we've got all these various governmental agencies that have some interest in it based on that. Now, the FBI, we know, investigated UFOs, even though they claim, no, we really didn't do it. We've got all kinds of documentation that shows they did. So we have the intelligence organizations involved in it. We've had congressional investigations, all this sort of thing going on forever. So when the president tries to corral that information, the answer is always, well, we've got to pull it in from all these other agencies and we'll get back to you. Now we have this thing supposedly coming up in June where they've done that. They have to report to the Senate Intelligence Committee about what they found in their 6 months of research.
Right.
And I will bet you cash money that there is going to be a great section that is not released to the public, and what is released is going to be redacted some fashion. We're not going to see the whole picture. And that's the way they do it. They say, well, this is part of national security. And we can point to the UFOs being a threat to national security, contrary to what the Air Force said, contrary to what the Condon Committee said. There was a series of sightings in Belt, Montana, and I'm not going to say in 1947. It was in, I think, late 1967. And the sightings were investigated by the Condon Committee. But at the same time, at Malmstrom Air Force Base, which is right near Belt, Montana, there was an incident where the missiles, ballistic missiles, and one whole flight of missiles was shut down from an outside source, which is not supposed to happen. And when the Condon Committee went to Belt, Montana to investigate the sightings, they talked to the UFO officer there. And he was giving them the information about the sightings that they had investigated, until the investigator from the Condon Committee asked about this missiles going offline, and he said, I can't talk to you about that. That's national security. Now, we know from the testimonies, I think Robert Hastings was instrumental in gathering an awful lot of this information and getting it out to the public arena, there were UFO incidents going on around the missile silos at the same time. What that told, would have told the enemy had that information got out, is there is a way from an outside source to disable their missiles. That's a matter of national security. And I think that's why part of the cover-up persists until today. It's a matter of national security, regardless of what they say. There are national security aspects to it.
Well, that is kind of fascinating, and I'm sure many people have thought this before, that, you know, July 1947 was the Roswell crash, and then in September of 47, you know, Air Force began. Was there some correlation or some connection between that, or is that just a coincidence?
I think that's a coincidence that they were splitting off. If you look at the documentation, you learn that in 1947, Dwight Eisenhower was the commander of chief of staff of the armies. But under him was the chief of staff of the ground forces and chief of staff of the air forces. And so there were two distinct organizations inside the army at that time, and they just split the air force off or spun the air force off into its own organization in 1947. But I think that was more or less a coincidence. The official investigation, Project Sign, did not begin until January of 1948.
Right.
They were caught kind of off guard by the Mantell incident, a National Guard pilot who was killed chasing what turns out probably to be a skyhook balloon, but was part of the UFO mythology. And I think what happened, and you go back and you read Ed Ruppelt's book, the report on unidentified flying objects, Ruppelt being the chief of Project Blue Book in the early 1950s, 1951, 1952. And he reported on what was going on in the Pentagon in June and July of 1947 and said they were in a panic. Huh. They didn't know what was happening. Suddenly, I think Roswell took place and they're presented with a technology that's clearly superior to anything we have.
Right.
They're talking about interplanetary flight as opposed to interstellar. But if it had been Soviet or something like that, it would have been also very, very frightening to them because they didn't know what was going to happen. But as time passed and they realized the invasion fleet wasn't standing off by the moon, the Soviets didn't have anything like that, they calmed down and they began to work to discover exactly what they had, what had been found, what they could learn from it. And so that kind of sets up another national security aspect as well. If it was an alien spacecraft, that is clearly technology that's far superior to where we are today, because we still can't fly across interstellar space. Well, we've got a probe out there, but it's not the same as sending a crew out into interstellar space. We can't do that.
Right.
But they can. And that presents a technology that is very frightening to them. But there is nothing coming into our society that really affects them now. If they land and say, here we are, that's a different story. But they're controlling the information right now. And anybody who's been involved in intelligence realize you control the information as best you can. And even if the enemy can out you, so to speak,
right,
you keep the secret. And the best example is Dwight Eisenhower, when Gary Powers was shot down over the Soviet Union in his U-2. And Dwight Eisenhower went forward and said, no, we are flying these things over the Soviet Union. We're not spying on the Soviet Union this way. Powers was supposed to destroy his aircraft and commit suicide. That was the deal. He didn't do it. The aircraft was shot down and he was captured. So after Dwight Eisenhower made this pronouncement, the Soviets trotted him out in pieces of the wreckage and said, here we go, guys. This is not true. But you control the information until the other guy who may have superior information comes forward with that superior information. So we look at all of that sort of thing. They're controlling the information right now. We can look at what has been released. We can look at sighting reports, and we can point to places where we had an opportunity to gather a great deal of information about UFOs. I think of the Levelland sightings in 1957, November of 1957, where the objects came close to the ground. They were seen in 13 separate locations. They stalled car engines. They caused radios to fill with static. They caused headlights to dim. Here was a series of sightings where the objects interacted with the environment. There is a tale from the sheriff that there was burned areas on the ground that I think Don Burlinson from Roswell, New Mexico, learned about in the year 2000, which doesn't do us any good at that point. But had that been investigated properly in 1957, I think we'd be having a whole different discussion. Mm. But they were able to suppress the information by convincing the law enforcement to downplay what was going on. There was a big argument between the Air Force and Don Kehoe of NICAP. Right. About the number of witnesses, and the Air Force said, well, there's only three witnesses, and Kehoe was saying there were nine witnesses. Going through the documentation available in the Air Force files and the newspapers, I found witnesses at 13 separate locations, and there's probably additional witnesses as well. If I made a bigger survey of the newspapers, I found additional witnesses. So they were able to downplay that and convince people there's nothing to it.
Right.
And then we get the hoaxers involved in all of this. Well, I took a ride in it, and there's a guy named Reinhold Schmidt who claimed right after Leveland had come out, says, yeah, saw a UFO, I took a ride in it, and his story turned out to be a hoax, and everybody remembers the hoax, but not the good sightings.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem with hoaxes, sometimes dilute or erase some of the good sightings. And that is. And for everybody out there, we have about 15 minutes left, but this is Kevin D. Randall. He has a new book. It's coming out tomorrow. You can get it on Amazon, and it's UFOs in the Deep State, War Against the Truth. And he's a retired lieutenant colonel of the Army. Let me correct that. And
well, to be fair, I did spend a number of years in the Air Force as well.
So. Oh, well, look, you must.
I moved around various services.
Okay. All right. Well, then we'll say a little bit of Air Force too in there then. But with the time we have remaining, I want to get a little more specific about some of the incidences that are in your book. And also, before we go, I want to ask you about the new traveling to Mars, and how you feel the deep state is a part of this, even though it's a private company. Well, actually, let's just start with that. How do you think the deep state, because they have to be a part of this trip to Mars, and what's it going to benefit? I always say, what's it going to benefit us to explore Mars and to even eventually colonize Mars? What is your take on that?
Well, if we can colonize Mars, then it takes the humanity out of a single place. You know, what happens if something huge hits the planet Earth and wipes out the human race? If we have a colony on Mars, well, that can't happen.
Right.
So that's one of the benefits there. And we don't know what kind of knowledge we would gain by going to Mars. If we say, well, what was the point of going to the moon? We didn't really gain a whole lot. We bought, 800 pounds of moon rocks.
Right.
That's a big deal. But our technology advanced immeasurably by the developments needed to put those guys on the moon. And that we're talking over a system now that wouldn't exist had it not been for the technological developments and the microprocessing developments that were created to put into the space capsule. So there's benefits in research and development, and we don't know exactly what we're going to find on Mars, but it's another place to go, a step into space. For example, the deep state is all about power, mm-hmm. and they can control this information, even if it's a private organization. If the deep state wants to destroy you, they certainly can do so. And we've seen some examples of it. I'm not sure the deep state doing it, but we've seen examples of governments, state governments and local governments, actually destroying businesses during the pandemic, forcing close downs and saying, you have to do this. And if you open your bar, we're going to arrest you. But applying it selectively. You know, you can't go to a bar, you can't go to a restaurant, but you can go out into the streets and protest. What's the difference there? You know, why could Hollywood have a catering service set up outdoors for their movie crews, and right next door, the restaurant couldn't open her doors, even though she had outside tables and that sort of thing? What is the point? There you see the operation of the deep state, the power they wield. You can't open your restaurant, but the Hollywood movie moguls, they can have their like a catering service outdoors like that.
Right.
And
right.
so it's, it devolves into power. And I think the thing here is they need to retain power. They can control who is able to create the stuff to go to Mars by putting all kinds of regulation.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen this in television programs all the time, the way they manipulate people into giving up information. Well, you know, if you don't help us out here, we'll see if the city inspector can come down and look at your wiring, and we'll get the health inspector in here, and we'll get the building code inspector in here, and we'll keep shutting it down, and we'll have a police car sitting outside your business establishment until you comply. That's the power of this deep state. That's done at the local level. That's really not part of the deep state. It just illustrates how they can operate. And so going to Mars is just one more step in, I guess, solidifying their power.
Right. I mean, it makes sense. And it is, I think it kind of throws people off when they say it's a private company, but deep state can infiltrate.
Well, you know, there was a movie, I think it was Destination Moon, where a private company was going to send a probe to the moon, and the government came in and shut them down because they said, well, your atomic reactors pose a threat to the surrounding community, so you can't launch. They launched anyway and went to the moon.
Right.
I think it was Destination Moon, but it showed that the government came in and tried to shut them down. And had they come a day earlier, they would have been able to do it. But there are ways to do it. You're violating this law. You're violating this regulation.
Right.
I had a friend who wanted to open a ice cream parlor in Lincoln, Nebraska. I'm sorry, Lincoln, New Mexico, in the old West town there. And one group of bureaucrats came in and said, well, you have to follow the way it would have been in the old West, which means you had to have square ice cream tubs. But the city, the health inspector says, came in and said, no, you can't have square tubs because you can't clean the corners properly. So you had two governmental agencies arguing or making regulations that inhibited the creation of this ice cream parlor in Lincoln, New Mexico. That's how they operate.
Well, what's funny is I think that's where a lot of the issues are, because we have so many different intelligence agencies, you know, that have probably information and they don't want to share it with each other because each agency wants its own power. Am I wrong on that?
No, absolutely. It's all about empire building. You get a bureaucrat right in there and he builds an empire. And we saw an awful lot of that during the Second World War, where the FBI and the OSS,
right,
I think it was really the Coordinator of Information first, but it became the Office of Strategic Services, were arguing about over who had the intelligence functions where. And the FBI was supposedly operating in the New World, and the OSS was operating in the rest of the world.
Right.
You see OSS guys operating in South America and FBI guys getting involved in Europe and all that sort of thing. So it's all about building power and building an organization and an empire. So there's also a lot of personal, I guess, empire building and glory hunting there as well. But it all benefits, in the end, it all benefits the deep states, because it keeps us out of understanding what's going on, because these organizations are working at odds with one another. But in the end, they're keeping the secrets from the rest of us.
So do you think the deep state, and because we've heard about, you know, many different types of aliens, but do you think there is some kind of peace treaty or some kind of treaty that keeps them from coming down? Because my thing is, if they have their technology is so way advanced, which it is, why don't they just land and say, okay, we're here. What of our current technology could stop them? Because a lot of people in the chat room are saying, why aren't they coming down? I want to see this before I die.
obviously, our technology is far inferior to theirs.
Right.
The answer may be something as simple as the Prime Directive, which was Star Trek, observe but don't interfere.
Right.
And it may be that sort of thing that we're being studied, because it would be very interesting to a civilization to learn how other civilizations grow and manifest themselves. And they don't want to influence the paths we take. Of course, there's the observer bias that we have to talk about. The mere presence of the observers alters things. But we're still arguing about whether there's alien visitation or not. So it hasn't altered that much. And I think that may be part of it, that they're doing it. I don't think there is a treaty going on. But in the book, I talk about a secret space program. And there was a secret space program. The New York Times reported that Vandenberg Air Force Base at one point had a training program for astronauts. I think there were 39 people involved in it, but they shut down in the late 1980s, I think it was, because they decided it was too dangerous.
Is this like interdimensional travel sort of or?
But I mean, that demonstrates and documents a secret space program that we didn't know about until it was closed down.
Was this like an interdimensional travel? Is that the almost like Stargate, the movie type of thing?
No, I think that would be a way to do it. No, I think it was more kind of NASA's way of doing launching chemical rockets into space type thing. But it was, but they're looking for those technologies as well. They're studying those sorts of things. And you talk to some physicists and they are looking for ways to defeat the speed of light as the limiting factor in the universe. And if we can do that, then we open up the pathways to interstellar flight. Hmm.
Well, before we get out of here, I know people really want to get this book. I mean, I know, unfortunately I've got to a chance to get a copy of it, and I appreciate that. It's a great book. How can people pick up the book? I know you have a blog that people can go read.
Well, yeah, the blog talks about lots more than just this. It's UFO related stuff, and it's also treasure hunting and things that interest me called A Different Perspective at www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com. The book is available on Amazon, and I looked at the numbers just before we connected here, and it looks like it's climbing up there. It had been kind of stationary, but I think if you order it on Kindle, I don't know if they'll send it out right now this minute, but they'll certainly do it after midnight. You can get it on your Kindle tomorrow, and you can order it through Amazon. They'll start shipping it tomorrow, so it's available on Amazon that way, and probably in other bookstores as well. I also do a radio show on the X Zone Broadcast Network at xzbn.net. It cleverly is called A Different Perspective. It usually airs on Saturday nights at 9 p.m. on various stations around the country. But there's a embedded audio player on my blog, and you can connect on that, and you can scroll through the programming, and I'm sure there'll be something that will be exciting. And the other thing is tonight, as per usual, every Thursday or Friday nights, I do a 3-minute segment on the Coast to Coast AM. So I'll be on just after the show begins in the first 20 minutes or so. I'll show up for a 3-minute segment. I do it either on Thursday or Friday nights. Tonight it happens to be on Friday.
That is great. And so make sure you tune in tonight to Coast to Coast if you didn't plan on it, because this amazing man, Kevin D. Randall, is going to be on. So. And for everybody asking questions in the chat room, I appreciate it. I may take one, but otherwise we have to go here in just about 1 minute. But Kevin, I really appreciate you coming on the show. And anytime you want to come back and share some more information about your, like you said, 100 and some thousand books that you've already written. But we appreciate you taking the time to do that, because not a lot of people... you know, they have an interest, but they don't put it on paper. So,
well, thank you for the opportunity as well.
All right. Well, thank you guys, everyone, for tuning in to Truth Be Told. We really appreciate it. Again, we're here every Friday. We're going to be doing 2 shows every Friday, from here on to the end of June, because, Contact in the Desert is going to be, coming up in June. The June 25th through the 28th, 2021. It's all virtual this year, unfortunately, but I'm going to be hosting some of the speakers, and we hope that you get your tickets, and hopefully maybe we can get some tickets away coming up in the next few weeks. Also, Brad Olson, who is going to be here next week, he's going to be co-hosting with me in May, and partially maybe some June shows. So it should be an interesting topic to interview some of our guests and have Brad Olson as my co-host. All right. Well, stick around, because we have a show right after this. So make sure you tune in. Until next time, I'm Tony Sweet. Appreciate you sharing, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.